Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Finsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. What does it take to create a truly equitable healthcare system? From entrepreneurs to investors to community workers from across the globe, this season we're speaking to the people aligning capital and technology to find the answer. This episode is produced in partnership with the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation as part of a series investigating the trends, challenges, and opportunities in the global healthcare sector. My guest today is Peter Drobak, Global Health Physician and Director of the Skoll Center for Social Entrepreneurship. The Skoll Center promotes social innovation by developing talent, promoting actionable insight through research, and catalyzing deep exchanges with a global community of innovators. Peter was a co-founder and first executive director of the University of Global Health Equity in Rwanda. Working at the intersection of health, education, and technology, the university will train the next generation of global health leaders and become a worldwide innovation hub for healthcare delivery science. For over a decade, Peter played a key role in the transformation of Rwanda's health system, which has delivered unprecedented gains in population health and prosperity. As Executive Director of Partners in Health in Rwanda, he established community-based health system incubators that developed and scaled care delivery innovations from infectious diseases to cancer. As Assistant Professor at Harvard Medical School, Peter taught global health, social medicine, and clinical infectious disease. Peter is also the host of Reimagine, a podcast series from the Skoll Center that reframes the world's most pressing problems to help us reimagine the future. We're grateful to have him here today to kick off our podcast series on equitable healthcare. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, Paul. Great to be with you.
I want to kick off on a kind of macro question. It seems that you've built a significant part of your career in Rwanda, a country that at the time was emerging from a terrible genocide and then sought to reconstruct its health system in a way that delivered favorable outcomes to the population. And you were at the very center of that endeavor. And it strikes me that the parallels to the present moment. We are facing an unprecedented pandemic with truly global and world-changing implications. And in the wake of that, as we hopefully emerge from it, we are going to have to think about many systems, our health systems in particular. And so I guess I'd like you to reflect on how you see us reconstructing or building back better health systems at this very unusual moment in human history.
Well, thanks, Paul. You know, we've all heard the saying that, in never waste a good crisis, or that in crisis, there's always opportunity. And what we're living through now is a series of multiple systemic crises. And I really see that as an opportunity for systemic change, that we can try to explore some of the deeper pathologies in our systems that have certainly set us back through this pandemic, but have infected our societies much more deeply, and try to reimagine what's possible. And as you say, this in some ways, I think, parallels the experience of Rwanda over the last 25 years. Coming out of the 1994 genocide, which took a million lives in 100 days, also really decimated the infrastructure and the social fabric of the country. What healthcare infrastructure there was absolutely decimated. You know, most doctors and nurses were killed or fled, etc. Life expectancy dipped into the mid-20s in the late 1990s. And so 10 years on in 2004, when I first came to Rwanda, there was still very much a process process of rebuilding, and we arrived at the government's invitation specifically to try to take advantage of this new wave of investment in the global AIDS movement to try to introduce HIV care and treatment to a population that was in desperate need of it. But what the government recognized, and I think what we agreed with, was that there was an opportunity to do something more than introduce HIV care, that we could use this as an opportunity to really reimagine what an equitable healthcare system could look like. And say, so we took, you know, we took money from the Global Fund and from other donors to treat HIV, and we said, yeah, we'll put patients on antiretroviral treatment, but we're also going to use these funds to put together the infrastructure so that the 97% of the population that doesn't have HIV but has lots of other health problems can also have access to care, maybe for the first time in their lives. And we're happy to talk more about what Rwanda's done, but that kind of approach, you know, really allowed them to almost start from scratch, think about what's possible, what kind of society they wanted to create, what kind of health system they wanted to create. And by really thinking systemically, it allowed for transformational change. You know, we saw a doubling of life expectancy over about a 15-year period. So certainly, I think there, you know, we're in a moment of despair right now. We're in the depths of this pandemic. We're in the depths of what's becoming probably an economic depression, and we're not quite sure how or when or where we're going to come out of it. But I think what we need to do is think about this pandemic as a dress rehearsal for 21st century problems. And if we can get this right, we'll be on much better footing for the fight against climate change and many other things.
So let's start with the country that we're both speaking to each other from, the United Kingdom. And although the United Kingdom has a proud tradition of healthcare delivery, particularly through the NHS, what the pandemic has shown is that it operates in very differential ways. The impact of the pandemic has been very differential on communities of color, on the poor. So do you think there is indeed an opportunity not to waste this crisis and begin to reconstruct a healthcare system starting here that might deliver more equitable outcomes? And if so, how might one go about doing that?
Well, I sure hope so. And it's been, of course, troubling but not surprising to see the emergence of disparities along racial and ethnic lines here in the UK, as well as in the US and many other places. Here in the UK, we've seen that Black communities, for example, face about a 4 times increased risk of death from COVID-19 relative to white communities. And I say not surprising because those kinds of disparities exist really across the health sector. And so you can look at outcomes from Canada, cancer, from other chronic diseases, and you see the same kinds of disparities. So what this is really showing us, that this is a symptom of a deeper systemic problem. So there are things we need to do in the short term to respond to these disparities, of course, and that might mean things like investing preferentially in testing centers in communities of color. When there's a vaccine available, hopefully in the coming months, we may want to think about prioritizing, you know, those communities amongst other groups for early access to the vaccine. But we really also need to then think about is, if this is a symptom of something deeper, that being a problem of systemic racism that infects every aspect of our society, we need to really interrogate that, confront it, and go deeper. And I do hope that it's an opportunity. There's been a call for an inquiry, not just into the government's response to COVID-19 early on, but particularly around this issue of the disparities of risk and outcomes in communities of color. That could be a tremendous opportunity for this country to confront both its history and also the present day dynamics of racial disparities. And I think unless we can look at that honestly and tackle it deeply, we can expect to see the same things with any other health problem.
So let's go into a little more detail on that. Can you explain with some examples how it is that systemic racism leads to disparate health outcomes and thereby to greater vulnerability in the face of COVID-19. What is it about systemic racism that has caused people to die at 4 times the rate based merely on the color of their skins?
You know, the causes will vary from place to place, but we see examples in almost every area. So, you know, on the front lines, for example, there is going to be some correlation between racial group and poverty. In poor communities, there may be lesser access to adequate health care, for sure. We, you know, sometimes we'll see that, for example, with COVID-19, that comorbidities like obesity, other chronic diseases can present risk factors for poor outcomes, and that you'll see higher incidence of some of those comorbidities in communities of color. But then you have to go deeper and say, well, why are the incidence of diseases like diabetes and hypertension happening at higher rates in communities of color? And that can come down to issues like housing situations and overcrowding, which can affect health. That can come down to issues of chronic stress. There's emerging, you know, literature that the chronic stress that can begin in childhood of living with racism can actually then affect one's health and increase risk of diseases like hypertension. We can see examples in the same ways that, you know, we've probably all seen some of the research that, for example, a Black person may be less likely to get hired or less likely to be invited for a job interview than a white person if you're just showing photos, or someone with an ethnic sounding name may be less likely to be invited for an interview. Those kinds of unconscious bias also, you know, are seen in healthcare systems as well. There was a recent study that demonstrated that neonatal mortality in Black mothers and babies is higher when the care provider is white than when the care provider is Black or a carer of color. So all of these dimensions, I think, feed into this. It's not that there's a single root cause or a single problem, but it's really something that infects every aspect of our society and our health systems, and that's something that we need to confront.
I want to ask you about the role of community health workers in helping to reduce healthcare inequity. Your work in Rwanda focused on the successful role of community health workers. And often in the North, one thinks of accessing medical care by going to a hospital or going to a doctor's surgery. But one doesn't think about having people visit you or a different cadre of people with different kinds of skills and perhaps widening access to healthcare. Can you tell us a little bit about the role of community health workers and perhaps how they might play a role in addressing some of the disparities that you've referred to, particularly in the North?
Community health workers, when we think of them as an integral part of the healthcare system, can be a really powerful way to improve access and to improve the quality of care in a number of ways. We have to understand that there are many barriers to accessing care apart from just inability to pay. For some people, it may be difficulty or the cost associated with making it to the health center. For somebody with chronic diseases, that might require multiple visits. There's opportunity costs in terms of having someone to care for the children, in terms of missing work. In some of the places that I've worked, reaching a health center might mean walking for 12 hours. And some people aren't physically going to be able to do that. Some people aren't going to be able to do that for other reasons. So the whole idea behind community health workers is simply bringing healthcare to the people as opposed to bringing people to the healthcare facilities. And that's an incredibly powerful thing, particularly with regard to, I guess, in two areas. The first is with the management of chronic diseases, whether that's HIV or diabetes, anything for which someone is going to need to have regular engagement with the healthcare system, for which they're going to need to adhere to a complex medical regimen, who are potentially going to be facing side effects and other kinds of things. Bringing the care into the home can really help to support someone's health outcomes. So you don't have to necessarily travel all the way to the health facility just to pick up a refill of your medicine or to have a checkup. The second is that community health workers can really be eyes and ears for the health system in the community and can sort of be first responders. So they can be the ones who, because community health workers are members of their own community, they know the community well, you know, they can be the ones who can understand that something unusual is happening. That could be an important early detection instrument for a new disease outbreak, but also they can understand the non-medical dimensions of someone's situation that may be holding them back in terms of improving their health and their healthcare, whether that's food insecurity, housing insecurity, domestic violence, mental illness. It allows us to give a much more sort of holistic approach. We've seen this to be an incredibly powerful approach in Rwanda. An army of over 30,000 community health workers was trained and is paid to be part of the healthcare systems. There are two community health workers in every village of the country. It's no accident that right now, in the context of COVID-19, that Rwanda's had just about 4,000 cases and only 16 deaths in the entire country of 12 million people. Part of that has been the use and deployment of community health workers for screening and testing, for delivering food packages during lockdown. Families who are living in extreme poverty on the margins cannot tolerate lockdown in the same way that you and I can, because we can order our groceries to be delivered. Lockdown is a matter of life or death for people who are living on the margins. And so the government, through community health workers, are actually delivering food packages to poor families to help them maintain the kind of social distancing restrictions. So it's incredibly powerful. We've seen so-called reverse innovation into settings in the global north. So, for example, community health worker programs that were developed in Haiti were then implemented in inner cities in the United States to take care of folks with advanced heart disease, with mental illness, with cancer. And it saved, in one study, over $50,000 per person per year, because you're keeping people out of the hospital. So it's a tremendously effective thing. And if we think about one of our big long-term aspirations around health equity, that's universal health coverage. That's making sure every child, woman, and man on the planet has access to adequate health care. It's going to be difficult to train and overcome the gap in the number of doctors and nurses that we would need to do that. Community health workers can be a really powerful tool for us to achieve universal health coverage.
Peter, I don't want to gloss over the Rwanda COVID statistics that you just went through. Will you say them again one more time?
Yeah, so at the time of recording, which is early September, Rwanda has had just over 4,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases and 16, that's 1/6, deaths.
In a population of?
Approximately 12 million.
So if you extrapolate that out, the UK has a population of about 66 million, there or thereabouts. And the number of excess deaths attributed to COVID is?
It's on the order of 50,000 to 60,000, depending on how you classify those excess deaths.
So if Rwanda was the same size as the UK and you scaled, just my back of an envelope would say that Rwanda, if it was the same size and you had the same proportion of deaths, would still have less than 100 deaths.
Sounds about right.
So that's an absolutely astonishing disparity. And what's really interesting about that is that often when you talk about disparities in health outcomes, countries in the global south have far worse health outcomes than countries in the north for resource and institutional and human resource reasons. Here's a country which, for many complex reasons, not solely attributable to community health workers, has managed to deal with a pandemic in a way that seems rather exemplary. Is there anything else about that experience that's worth drawing our attention to? Because it just seems so exceptional in so many ways.
I think one of the other factors that's so important has been leadership. And if you look across the world at the sort of countries that have had a fairly effective response and the countries that have really struggled, you don't find correlations along the lines of GDP or wealth. You don't find good correlations along the lines of the numbers of doctors or the amount of money spent per capita on healthcare. It really comes down to leadership. And we had some real failures of leadership leadership, particularly early on in the pandemic here, a sense of sort of exceptionalism and hubris that we've got all the, you know, smartest researchers and we have a great health system and we'll sort of figure it out, that we could, you know, we don't need to follow WHO guidelines. We can be cleverer than that, and we can time the spread of the disease just enough that it can spread through the population in a way that's not going to create too many deaths, but develop herd immunity. That was an early strategy, for example. The deputy chief medical officer, relatively early in the pandemic, was asked why the UK was not following World Health Organization guidelines. And she said, you know, those guidelines are for poor countries. They're for developing countries. We're the ones that have the expertise that guides WHO, not the other way around. Had we, in fact, followed that playbook, which Rwanda and many other countries did, you know, we would have averted, you know, certainly tens of thousands of deaths. In contrast, Rwanda and many other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, in part because this is not their first rodeo, because they have been living with the threat of epidemic infectious diseases for many years, were quick to see the threat, took this very seriously, and acted early and aggressively. So that's number one. I think number two has been that they were able to leverage a healthcare system that, while not overwhelmingly sophisticated in terms of the resources or the complexity of medical care that could be provided, was sophisticated in the sense that it covered the entire population, that it was robust, that it was integrated, and they were able to use that to develop a quick and effective response. And so there's a whole bunch of other things that we could talk about that Rwanda's done really well. I guess the last thing which I touched on before was this understanding that some of the measures that we would need to take in terms of social distancing to prevent the spread early on could have catastrophic consequences for particularly for poor communities, and that we can't just ask people to stay home in quarantine or in lockdown or what have you, but we had to support them. And the government's done this to some extent in the UK in terms of preventing job losses and things like that. But, you know, for example, when we're asking people to stay home in quarantine, we should be supporting them as well. And so what the government in Rwanda did in providing food support and other things really helped, I think, people to make it through and to survive this, but also to kind of hold society together with a sense of common purpose. And that's been really important as well. And again, comes back down to leadership, communicating clearly, communicating based on the science, not saying we're based on the science, but actually basing it on the science, and understanding that this is something that is going to require a contribution from everybody in our society to kind of pull together for the common good. That's something that Rwanda's done really effectively, and I think that can't be discounted.
That is an astonishing account, and I think the statistics speak for themselves in terms of successes and failures of dealing with the pandemic. I want to now ask you a question, not so much in how countries have dealt with the pandemic at its height, but to ask you to prognosticate a little bit about how we begin, hopefully, to emerge from this moment. And particularly, I know you followed the question of vaccines very, very closely. So the first question is, give us your best sense of where we are today on vaccine development and when you anticipate that they will begin to come to market in a way that might in fact impact the trajectory of the pandemic.
There has been unprecedented scientific cooperation and unprecedented speed in terms of scientific research and discovery to develop vaccines, diagnostics, and therapeutics for COVID-19, but I think particularly with regard to vaccines. So there are well over 150 vaccines in development and several dozen that are in human clinical trials right now, including several that are in late-stage clinical trials that we call phase phase three, which involve tens of thousands of subjects and are the ones that can allow us to both ensure that the vaccines are safe, but prove that they are effective. So with several of the leading candidates, they've already been able to demonstrate in smaller numbers levels of safety and that they can generate an immune response. What we don't know is whether that immune response translates to actual protection from infection, or at least protection that if you get infected, you don't get severe disease. That's what phase three clinical trials are for. So as I mentioned, several of those are underway, including the vaccine that's been developed here in Oxford. With three or four of them, we anticipate that we may have at least initial phase three trial results in the months to come. One company is saying as early as October. I think more realistically, we're looking towards the end of the 2020 calendar year. It's possible, I don't say necessarily likely, and I wouldn't bank on it, but it's possible that one or more than one of these vaccines may have results that demonstrate safety and efficacy. Efficacy just means they work adequately that we might then start to deploy it. One of the really important things that's been happening throughout this has not just been massive investment in the development of vaccines, but understanding there's going to be a huge challenge in manufacturing vaccines in adequate numbers. We're talking about a two-dose vaccine system. Right? It requires a booster. So that is, 14 billion doses potentially that we're going to need across the world. So investments have been made in a lot of the lead candidates to give advanced guarantees so that we can scale up the production of several of the leading candidates such that hundreds of millions of doses would be available by the end of this year if we find one that's effective. So there are a lot of candidates. And one of the really important mechanisms in place right now is something called the COVAX facility, which is the Global Vaccine Access Facility for COVID-19. And that's a multilateral sort of commitment that over 170 countries have signed on to, with a notable exception of the United States, to basically put forward resources for wealthy countries so that we can pool those resources and give these advanced market guarantees. And the idea is to ensure that at least 20% of the population of every country participating in COVAX could receive adequate vaccines by the end of 2021. And that would allow us to at least vaccinate the highest risk folks. These could be healthcare workers and others on the front line, elderly, and potentially communities of color. So that's extraordinarily exciting. It's by no means guaranteed. We have to remember there's never been an effective vaccine against a coronavirus developed before. And there have been many, many, many promising vaccines and drugs that have made it to phase three trials and then sputtered and failed. So we have to hope for the best, but I think also plan for a scenario in which the news is disappointing and it takes us longer to get there than we hope, or that the vaccines are less effective than we hope. We don't know how long immunity will last when an effective vaccine is found. It might be that you need to get revaccinated every year or every couple of years. So it doesn't change the fact the end game for this pandemic is going to have to involve a vaccine or several vaccines potentially. But it doesn't mean that we can just sort of sit back and wait or hope. And just because there's a possibility that a vaccine may be around the corner, is not an excuse for us not to be doing everything we possibly can right now to control the virus and to save lives. And in so doing, save the economy and prevent the kind of ripple effects that we're seeing right now with the economic devastation and, the loss of life from other diseases as health systems come under strain and so on. So, for example, in the U.S., it's been just an absolute disaster. There's been no strategy, no coordinated effort to really tackle the pandemic. And now all the talk is just about when the vaccine is coming out. Meanwhile, it continues to rip through the entire country. And we've gotten to a place where we're numb to 1,000 deaths a day in the United States. And that to me is unconscionable. So in short, vaccine, I hope it's coming. There might be some good news by the end of the year, but I wouldn't absolutely bet my life on it.
So as you say, the end game here will entail a vaccine of some form. How effective over what time scale remains open to question. But since this conversation is about health equity, I want to ask you a hard distributional question, which is to say, If you were able to allocate vaccine to cover 20% of a country's population and do so in a way that targeted poor people, people of color, frontline health workers, teachers, other kind of critical frontline workers, would you be able to significantly reduce mortality rates and reduce spread by a targeted application of the vaccine to a relatively small percentage of the population, and thereby significantly, almost disproportionately improve both health and economic outcomes? Is that at least one way to think about how you deal with this in distributionally just ways?
Yeah, I think that they're probably separate issues. The issue of reducing the mortality rate, or the overall number of deaths, and reducing the spread. On the first question, I think the answer is yes. Absolutely, we need to make sure that that health workers and other key workers on the front lines are prioritized, because they're the ones that are going to keep our health systems running. You know, there was a report yesterday from Amnesty International that estimated that 7,000 health workers around the world have lost their lives to COVID-19 already, and that's absolutely unconscionable. You know, and we don't talk much about shortages of personal protective equipment as much anymore, but it's still a real issue. We wouldn't send firefighters or police officers or soldiers into harm's way without adequate, armor, helmets, and protective gear, but we still are doing that with health workers, and so that's got to stop. So certainly, I think they need to be amongst that priority list for obvious reasons. If we're then able to prioritize those individuals or those groups that have disproportionately high mortality rates, the elderly, those with certain medical comorbidities in communities of color, we should be able to drive down mortality rates significantly with an effective vaccine. The other thing to keep in mind is actually that our ability to care for folks with this disease has improved quite a bit over the last several months, both through research and developments like the use of corticosteroids like dexamethasone to significantly reduce mortality, strategies about how to ventilate those who are critically ill. So over time, we're seeing death rates fall as our ability to care for folks improves, particularly in places with advanced medical systems. And that's why these efforts to kind of, buy time and slow the spread have been so important, because without a doubt, mortality rates or case fatality rates are lower now than they were six months ago. In terms of slowing the spread, Paul, what's estimated from the modeling based on what we know of this disease is that we would need to have immunity in the population on the order of at least 50%, possibly 60-70%, before there is a kind of population level or herd effect in terms of kind of slowing the spread and giving the virus nowhere to go. Immunity could happen through natural infection, people getting sick and recovering, or through vaccinations. Vaccinating 20% of the population would have perhaps some marginal benefit. It wouldn't be enough on its own necessarily to slow the spread. And that, again, just highlights the need for us to understand that we have to play a long game here. Doesn't mean we need to go back into lockdown or stay in lockdown for months or years at a time, but we're going to need to alter our way of life in terms of masking and social distancing, in terms of agreeing on some societal trade-offs. What are the things that really matter to our society, schools or pubs, right? And we have to decide what we want to not do in order to promote the health of the population. You know, those choices are not going to go away even in the early days of a vaccine.
So I want to pivot to ask some questions about innovation and health equity beyond the pandemic. Just from a kind of high level perspective, where do you see entrepreneurial innovation occurring that is helping to improve health outcomes, but also health equity? And where do you think there's scope for additional research, perhaps investment, perhaps public-private partnerships? Just sort of sketch out some kind of high-level areas that you think we should have our eye on.
Well, first off, I hope that the kind of global Manhattan project that's underway with research and development around COVID-19 in vaccinations, in diagnostics and therapeutics can spill over, you know, that it can generate new understandings, new methodologies and new technologies that can spill over into our ability to address a number of other health problems, not just be better placed for the next potential pandemic, but hopefully in many other ways as well. You know, for example, our understanding of immunology and the immune response to COVID-19 and all of the mysterious things that are happening in those who have recovered from COVID-19 but are still displaying chronic effects, whether that's cardiac inflammation, whether that's chronic fatigue, whether that's difficulties with concentration and neurologic problems. There's so much happening that we really don't understand at all. And that's going to be an important area of research, but I think being able to kind of understand the way that not the virus itself, but our immune response to the virus is causing harm could be tremendously powerful for our understanding of how the immune system is involved with health in so many other areas. To zoom out more broadly, obviously it's a really exciting time in terms of healthcare innovation with regard to one other thing that we've sort of seen during the pandemic is it's accelerated a trend towards telemedicine and the use of technology to provide care delivery without as much kind of physical contact, without having someone to go into a doctor or nurse's office. And that's happened for obvious reasons. And that's a really important and high potential way to improve access for folks around the world. So in some ways, though, I think we're always going to need to have the power of human-to-human in-person caregiving, the ability to do more of this remotely, the ability to use artificial intelligence to harness a phenomenal amount of data to help us make better decisions is a tremendously powerful area. Virtual reality, one of our ventures that came from one of our students here in Oxford at the School Center called Virtue Health, is using a virtual reality program to provide reminiscence therapy for people with dementia, allowing them to immerse themselves in a world that's more familiar from a different time and access long-term memories. So some really powerful stuff. One of the things that I think from an equity standpoint we need to think about is how these kinds of technological advancements risk worsening health disparities as opposed to improving them, right? And this is true of any new technology, right? It was true of internet access, in the early days, certainly with regard to genomic and personalized medicine and our ability to both do rapid sequencing and soon gene editing. Tremendously powerful, could save a lot of lives, but it again has the potential to worsen disparities if it's only offered to those who have the ability to pay or in wealthy countries. And then there's a deeper issue to that as well. A lot of us have heard about the ways that artificial intelligence can reinforce biases, right? That AI is racist and can't identify the faces of Black people, for example. And that's because the biases that we have when we're programming these things get then embedded into the code, essentially, and can perpetuate inequalities. The same thing could happen if we're doing genomic medicine based on biobanks of predominantly white or wealthy or Western populations. So, there are some interesting efforts. There's a Nigerian company called 54 Gene that's looking to develop a biobank from volunteers of genetic information from every country in Africa. So if we have a more diverse bank of genetic material from which we're basing all of this research and development, we can hopefully have more equitable and more effective discovery. So that's something I think we need to really keep in mind. With all of these efforts, we need to think about how to have an equity lens.
I think you're very unusually well-placed to answer the following question. As a person who runs a center around social entrepreneurship and who spent his life in public health, right now, there is a big trend to try and allocate capital in ways that don't just seek profit, but also seek impact. And the whole world of social entrepreneurship and impact investing is in some ways trying to see if you can mobilize the dynamism of entrepreneurship and the power of capital to scale up solutions to some of the world's most difficult problems. Now, in the health sector specifically, seeking to obtain financial returns from innovation and from entrepreneurial endeavors in some ways can occur to the detriment of equity or distribution because you're placing profit in private hands. But on the other hand, there has to be a really important role for impact investing in this space. So tell us how you sort of at an almost first principle level think about the contribution of impact investing to tackling health equity.
Well, I think there's massive opportunity here. And it, as impact investing sort of goes more mainstream and more global, the health sector is probably one of the most important and promising areas for growth. And if we think about the ultimate goal being universal health coverage, this idea that every person on the planet has access to high quality healthcare, that has to be regardless of ability to pay. It's going to be difficult, if not impossible, in some settings for governments to get there by themselves. We've certainly seen places where that has largely been the case, but in most cases, it's going to need to be public-private solutions. And so when we think about the role of the private sector in addressing some of the gaps, not just in terms of innovation, but actually in terms of delivery of health services to last-mile communities, to other poor and hard-to-reach communities, the need is there, and that's where I think that social entrepreneurs and social ventures come in, because you need to be able to ensure that the financial return imperative is not going to cause you to worsen those disparities, right? That you're going to turn people away, for example, because they're too poor to pay. I think there are ways around that, and we've seen many examples of that. I think it helps when governments are supportive of private sector engagement, particularly of social entrepreneurs, having a facilitative ecosystem for it, but also one that kind of coordinates so that the private sector and the public sector are not working in competition, but actually thinking holistically about how the private sector can fill gaps, can identify new opportunities, can identify new ways of approaching a hard problem is really important. One thing that I'd really like to call on the impact investment community to help us do and to think about is decolonizing social entrepreneurship. And, I say this with some, humility as someone who has been, I guess, a social entrepreneur and working in sub-Saharan Africa as a white American male. We see such a disparity, and I don't have data in front of me, but if you were to look at where impact capital is going in Africa, it's going to go overwhelmingly to ventures that are founded by white, well-educated Westerners, much more than local entrepreneurs. And that's a real problem for a lot of reasons, not least because top-down solutions rarely work as well as they could or as transformational as they could. We need a lot more bottom-up innovation that's coming from the front lines. We need to harness the power of communities with lived experience to be able to solve problems. So what I would love to see is how the impact investment community could help to harness the tremendous entrepreneurial spirit and brain power that exists across the world in the poorest communities in the world to help to cultivate and catalyze social entrepreneurs and social ventures in those communities. That, to me, is what's ultimately going to transform things. It's hard, right? If you had two social ventures that were doing, mental health in Africa, and one of them is founded by a local Kenyan person educated locally, and one is founded by a Stanford MBA with lots of credentials and has been to the Skull World Forum and spoken on the TED stage and things like that, it's always going to go to the latter person. We need to think about how we can overcome obstacles and create a runway for everybody else, because the next great idea can come from anywhere, and talent is equally distributed, but opportunity is not. So again, impact investing needs to take an equity lens to their work if they really want to have a transformational impact.
I couldn't agree with you more. And later in this series, we will hear from Betty Marimbi from Mothers to Mothers, who is an absolutely remarkable woman who will speak to us from Uganda, and who I would bet on any day of the week, because she is not only as eloquent and sophisticated as anybody on the planet, but also benefits from a deep rootedness in the communities that she's seeking to work from. And I think the combination of those two things is so essential. Petra, I want to ask for some closing thoughts. The first is, you've seen countries that are emerging from incredible violence and from despair and working in infectious diseases. You've been to hard places. Tell us a little bit about what, at a moment like this, nevertheless gives you hope.
Throughout my career, and as you say, I've worked at times in some difficult situations, though, you know, never more difficult than most of the people that I was working with or trying to help serve. Still, really, some tough situations and some hard times. I think with great compassion about the doctors that we read about in Italy and Spain and New York City, who had to make impossible decisions about, you know, which of two dying people to give the last ventilator to. Having been in those kinds of situations, you know, what's always given me hope have been the little victories, and those little victories kind of exist every single day. You know, one win with one person, one great new idea, and I think we're seeing those little victories all over the world today. I think the vaccine and the scientific research effort has given me a lot of confidence in the power of human ingenuity when we all put our heads together and we all cooperate to solve big hard problems. The fact that we've seen places like Rwanda, like Thailand, which has gone 100 days without a single case of community transmission of COVID-19, that have been able to pull together and set an example for the world, that gives me hope. The ways in which the pandemic has turned the world upside down, you know, going back to this notion that we don't need WHO, we give the WHO our expertise, that kind of neo-colonial mindset, that exceptionalism, you know, that's all been kind of blown apart. And the fact that we're seeing some of the best examples of what's possible coming from unlikely places, I hope that can change some mindsets and help us understand that the next great idea can come from anywhere. As I say, I think this pandemic is a dress rehearsal for 21st century problems. I'm not convinced we're going to get it right. But if we can come out of this and figure it out, and we can, you know, not succumb to fear and nationalism and division as much as some of our leaders are pushing for that right now, if we can come out of this together, we're going to be so much better placed to confront the climate crisis, confront the assaults on democracy that we're facing, and so much else. So I think a lot is riding on our actions in the next several years.
I think that's a remarkable note upon which to end, that there is great cause for hope, but no cause for complacency. And what will make the difference is engaged people seeking to act and seeking to forge solutions, not being passive. And you, I believe, are at the forefront of that. So thank you for everything you do and for your contributions. We look forward to being in touch again in the future.
Thanks for having me on, Paul.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation, please visit chwi.jnj.com. Once more, chwi.jnj.com. And for more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.